You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Daryl Gregory is the author of many novels, including The Spoonbenders and the album of Dr. Moreau. His new album is... Daryl Gregory is the author of many novels, including Spoonbenders and the album of Dr. Moreau. His new novel is Revelator. Thank you for joining me, Gregory.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.
This is a really interesting novel. And the first thing I realized when I set out to read it and got ways into it, it is vastly different from Spoonbenders. Spoonbenders is like a kind of antic comedy. The settings are urban and suburban and you know, top secret CIA, spies, Uri Geller influenced. This is like, you know, Flannery O'Connor and H.P. Lovecraft having a quiet dinner in the most rural diner in the Appalachians man could find. Talk about choosing different historical periods, researching them, and coming up with really different novels.
Yeah, well, I guess that's because it's the two sides of my life. So I was raised in Chicago, grew up there, in, you know, in the 70s and 80s. But my parents were Southerners who came out of East Tennessee, and they came north for jobs. My dad worked for Reynolds Aluminum, which had been split off from Alcoa, which was a Reynolds company that plays a big part of the book in Revelator. And so I always had this two sides of my family where at home we sort of spoke Southern, and my parents used words that nobody else used at school. But then I was being raised in Chicago, and we were constantly going back to Tennessee. And so all my relatives are in East Tennessee, and both sides of my family come out of this one particular part of East Tennessee called Cades Cove, which became part of the Smoky Mountain National Park. So I would, on one hand, Spoonbenders is a Chicago novel, and I actually had to research the period in which I was living there to find out some amazing things, like the level of mob activity I was totally oblivious to. And then there's this Southern novel, which is basically set during a time period when my parents were growing up in the South. So, yeah, it's just two sides of my life.
You know, one of the things that struck me immediately about this novel as I went further into it is it has a really interesting and important contemplation at its heart, which is about the nature of God and the nature of religion. And this is something we confront all the time, because we now live in a world that's dominated by science and where there's no real physical evidence for the existence of God. And your novel contemplates something rather different. Talk about the religious center to this novel.
Yeah, so I grew up going to a Southern Baptist church in Chicago, where all the other Southerners, they sort of found each other in the North. And so I grew up with that religion. And I was really interested in, like hearing all the Bible stories when you're a kid, you kind of long for this Old Testament feeling when it was your God was right there in front of you. I remember being a kid saying, well, this seems really abstract. I never see any gods. I don't see God. I don't see Jesus. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we have a character whose God is right there with her in the mountain? So Revelator is about a girl who's sort of raised as a quote revelator. She's supposed to go into this cave where their family's personal God is living, and commune with the God, and then come out with scripture, basically come out with a message from the God, and the men sort of take over the message and start writing their own scripture about it. But I love this idea of, well, what do you do when you can reach out and actually touch your God, and how would the family make sense of that? because there's this strange thing happening. And then they have to put a frame around it. And the frame they put around it is to make it another branch of Christianity, because that's their frame in Cades Cove, Tennessee. So
the primitive Baptists, and you have a passage in here in your book where you write, Baptists of other flavors made an appearance, Apostle missionary Baptists still carrying a grudge after splitting with the primitives in the 1830s, Southern Baptists, Pentecostals, Independents, Methodists made an appearance, and even a couple of Maryville Episcopalians. I love this kind of quilt work religion, you know, that there are so many different ways to see the underneath reality.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, and the joke in the South is that, you know, wherever you have two Baptists, you got three opinions, right? So they would join together and get in a fight and split up and form different churches about different theological issues. There really were, my friend of mine who was a writer, read the book, is like, you can't make up a church called Primitive Baptist. That's too on the nose. I'm like, no, that's the name of the church there. And the great thing about Cades Cove is you can go back to the Smoky Mountain National Park and they preserve the Primitive Baptist Church. They preserve the Baptist Church. I think there's a Methodist church there. And so you can see all these churches and all these communities were there. And and then they would tussle with each other. And my dad always said there were three types of Gregories: the nose Gregories, because we had big noses, and then there was the preaching Gregories and the whiskey Gregories. So the people who made moonshine and the preaching Gregories, and maybe sometimes those overlapped. The jury's still out.
They all make an appearance in the novel in one form or another. You know, one thing I like about this is that it's kind of a small scale thing. You can almost see it as like one of those stripped down Twilight Zone episodes where there's Maudie, the grandma, and Stella, the main character, in this, rundown old, wood cabin in what will soon be a national park. Talk about, you know, the creating the dynamics, because this is a very intense page turner. One thing I like about it too is this novel wears its sausage on its sleeve, as they used to say in Mad Magazine. We meet the god in the mountain in the very first chapter, and I like that because you don't hold back, but you don't tell us everything, and that's where all the tension in the novel comes from.
Well, yeah, and you know, part of that came from saying, you know, okay, here's your ticket into the book. We're going to introduce the weirdness. So it's not going to be something where there's a lot of cult books where you're not sure if what's happening is real or not for a very long time. And I just thought, no, let's get the creature onto the page early and then we're going to deal with all the ramifications. So if you can get past that ticket, because there may be people who just say, this is not my kind of book. I'm not going to read about something that lives in a cave that they're worshiping down there. And so I'm like, good, you should know early for that. That's my warning to you. So I wanted to set that up and then play out all the ramifications of this whole system, because when Stella enters the story, she's coming back to Tennessee after being in Chicago with her father, and he's basically dropping her off with her grandmother and saying, well, see you. I'm going to go back to work in Chicago. You're going to be staying here with your grandmother. And there's this entire hidden legacy of being a revelator that she's has to learn about. And so we learn about it with her. And so I'm hoping people find all that stuff interesting. You mentioned, like, yeah, the moonshine is a part of this. I used the recipe from my Uncle Clinton, who was a moonshiner.
Really? Because I love, one of the things I thought, boy, this guy really learned about the stills and still tech and moonshine tech. I mean, it's high tech stuff, but so this is actually from a family recipe then.
Yeah, this is a family recipe. My Uncle Clinton sat me down and we did a little tasting and he walked me through his process and his recipe for for making moonshine, because it was just an important economic thing to do. Like, so if you're living in Cades Cove, and you, let's say you want to grow corn and sell it. If you want to carry all that stuff all the way to Maryville or to Knoxville, it's a huge endeavor. But if you distill it down into whiskey, you can transport that on a couple mules. You can take all that corn and you can distill it down and have a high value thing that you can take to town. And that's, I mean, that's a huge reason behind moonshine. And then, of course, when the government comes in and starts taxing it, a lot of the poor folks there said, we're not paying taxes. And that's where you get revenuers. And that's where you get, you know, the bootlegging aspect of sneaking the moonshine around town. And so Stella learns the art of moonshine from her neighbor, Abby, who's living with her as a child. And then part of the novel takes place when she's older and running her own sort of high tech Walter White style ultimate moonshine facility and distributing it around Maryville and Knoxville.
You mentioned Abby, and that brought to mind yet another writer who is more than nodded to in here. Abby's full name, which we learned partway into the book, is Absalom. And I'm thinking, oh, wow. Yeah. Faulkner. Of course. Yes. Faulkner.
Yeah. I mean, my nod to Faulkner, thanks for noticing that. You know, you slip some things, Absalom, you sort of slip in there. But I love those old fashioned names that come out of, they would sort of pull names out of the Bible, and that could be your name. You know, you could, your name could be Righteous Jones.
Well, two, one of the things that's interesting about this book, you mentioned it, the story is told in layers, back, going back and forth between when she first arrived and when she comes back. And also, what happens in here is we learn a lot of the history of this area, which has to do with you know, the Civil War and the part that Tennessee played, which is not as clear-cut as I might have assumed.
No, it's a really, especially Cades Cove was really divided. In fact, those churches that we were talking about had different takes on whether to join the Union or join you know, the Confederacy, and sometimes families were split. So my ancestor, Russell Gregory, was killed by Confederate soldiers. They had, Cades Cove had mostly declared for the Union side, but his son went off and joined the Confederacy. And his son knew when, at the tail end of the war, when the Confederate soldiers are basically starving, they knew they could go into Cades Cove and steal people's stocks and steal their cows and feed the army. And so famously, his son came back into the Cove leading some people, and Russell Gregory, who at the time was an old man, headed them off. And the local guard at that point was just women and old people. That's all who was protecting the Cove anymore. And they basically headed them off with guns sort of kept them away. But then the Confederates came back later and killed Russell Gregory, you know, in his bed. And there's two competing stories. Either they shot him in his bed, or Russell Gregory heard that they were down in his pasture stealing his cows and came down the hill after them, and they shot him while he was running at them. But on his gravestone, you could go to, you know, the Smoky Mountain National Park and the grave and the cemetery where he's buried, where you'll say Russell Gregory, you know, killed by rebels on his gravestone.
And the national park plays a part in this novel too, because that's how you ratchet up the tension for the god in the mountain, because he's about to be put behind the walls of a national park and deprived of his flock. Talk about, you know, this is something that has happened throughout history, and it's interesting that the novels that deal with it often deal, you know, are horror novels. I'm thinking of a book called My Heart is a Chainsaw, which is set around Stephen Graham Jones, set around a lake where, you know, the lake was created artificially over another village, which proves to be an unfortunate decision.
Right. Well, and especially in the tradition of Southern Gothic, which this book is, Southern Gothic sort of run on isolation, and the fact that they're inaccessible even in modern Southern Gothic, cell phones don't quite work. People are the idea that nature can seal you off is a running theme of a lot of horror. And then gentrification comes in, and it's like it's destroying mystery. So it's almost like bittersweet. The horror may be stopped or changed by this intrusion of civilization, but it's the end of the era. And so one reason I was really interested in this time period is because my family talks about it a lot. So both sides of my family were kicked out of the Cage Cove when they made it a national park, and they were sort of by eminent domain forcibly bought out and told to get out. And my uncle Albert, who was born in the Cove, never took the federal government. He'd never thought they had taken it correctly and had any right to it. So he would hunt in this federal preserve and take out deer and just hunt all the time. We're like, Albert, that's a federal crime now. He's like, well, they can't stop me. And he's dead now, so I can tell tales. But yeah, my family basically thought this was an unfair taking. And the weird thing is that later it turned out to be kind of a beautiful thing in that I can bring my kids there. My dad brought me back to the Cove a lot, because once it became a park, then it was development stopped in this area, actually. And so it's sort of preserved. They've saved some of the homes. They've saved some of the places where we can hike, where our homes were. We can go to the churches my people went to. And that's kind of beautiful. But it was the end of an era. Like that community was over as soon as it got declared a park.
You know, it's interesting. You're well into your career as a novelist. You've written lots of novels. Did you ask yourself when you were writing earlier novels, when's it going to come time for me to deal with my family? Why did you bring it up now? I mean, because, my God, this is a great legacy you brought to this novel, which shows through in the, I guess, intensity of the emotional connection the reader forms.
Yeah, you know, so my second novel is actually set in East Tennessee. It didn't sell well. and I think, I wish now... I think I had to wait to get a little older and get a little better as a writer to take it on in a better way. And sometimes that happens when you're young and brash. You can write novels where you think, oh, I'd like another crack at that. But that was the best novel I could write at the time, and that was called Devil's Alphabet, and it's set in the modern day, in the same area of Tennessee. And there's a bunch of thematic things that are connected between the two books, but they're two different eras. And in this time, I wanted to go back to, I just felt like I wanted to do this story about my parents, the era they grew up in, when, weirdly enough, modernism is coming in too. Like, you know, there's Nancy Drew and Hardaway books, there's movies, there's all this stuff. And so there's this tendency to see the South as you know, trapped in a bottle. But what was happening was this constant tension between traditional values and raising the farm, but then there was all this stuff going on with the modern world intruding, especially after World War II, part of the book set in the 40s. And so Alcoa, the aluminum plant where my whole family worked for Alcoa Aluminum, really boomed during World War II. We needed a lot of airplane wings. We needed a lot of material for the war. Became a booming thing. And so everybody sort of worked for them. And so suddenly my people, who had always been farmers, had factory jobs and maybe a side farm that they were trying to keep running. That's the way my grandfather did it. He worked at the plant and that was his regular salary. And then would try to keep the rest of the farm running when he could at nights and weekends. And it's a weird part of American history when industrialization comes to the South and people have to make decisions about how do we want to go forward? Like, what are we going to preserve and what are we going to take on as new?
It's also a part of history, what you point out, where we tend to think that America has always been a patriarchy, but that in at least in this novel, that's not the case. Mahdi, who is the head of what's left of Stella's family, is, you know, she is an indomitable and wonderful matriarch. I mean, God, I don't know who's going to get to play her in the miniseries, but that they will have some, they better be ready to choose some serious scenery.
Well, I've always written about strong women, and my experience is that the women are tremendously strong, but there are these patriarchal structures. Like in the church I grew up in, even in Chicago, the women were not allowed to vote on any church issue. And that was true in every Southern church that my family came out of. So only the men could vote. And it drove my mom crazy. At one point, they were holding a vote about which kitchen equipment to upgrade. And none of these men had used any of the church stoves or anything and were going to buy the cheapest thing. And my mom just got so mad about it. So there was always, there was another way of doing power if you're a woman, because you were kind of shut out from the formal power. So you, but your influence and your control over your own lives was really important. And so I wanted to write in this book, in Revelator, there's only the women can go into this cave and commune with the God in the mountain. But when they come out sort of delirious and are speaking all these mixed up words as they're trying to interpret the thoughts that they're getting from the God and turn them into English, the men are changing and writing down the scripture and keeping the quote, the official books. But the women have their own separate oral tradition where they know the truth that they're passing on one to another. And the men are sort of saying, no, this book that I've written, I've transcribed and signed my name to, that's the real religion. And so there's this constant tension between them.
And that brings us to, I guess, the quote big bad of the novel, which is not the giant monster that lives in the mountain. It's Hendrix, her uncle. So talk about, you have a lot of fun with him and his church and how he works. It's really the writerly craft in creating this guy is well on display and very enjoyable.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, he's he can be charming, and he realizes that, you know, he's moved away from the coven and he's going to come back and he's going to sort of take control. And his whole goal is to, if we can film this monster, if we can expose it, I'll be the head of this new church. I'll have all of these followers. And so he's trying to make something happen. Which neither Stella nor the God want to happen. Stella would like the cycle of sending young women into this cave to end. And that's, she spends most of the book trying to ensure that doesn't happen to the next person in line, who's a girl named Sunny, who has tons of secrets on her own, which we won't talk about. But I loved Henrik because he's very invested in building a structure out of these random things that these women are saying when they come out of the cave, and building a structure that coincidentally happens to put him at the head of the church. And that's going to be his way out, because everybody was sort of broke in the 30s. You know, everybody's reeling from the Depression. The economy was depressed, and a lot of people had to split up and find jobs. Like I was talking about with, you know, with Alcoa, he actually has to travel and set up another place in Georgia, but still the lure of setting up the church is what draws him back.
You know, you mentioned Alcoa a few times. Talk about making a company, a player in your novel.
Well, I was really struck by this idea of distillation and the way that, you know, smelting aluminum works, and the way that the whole industrialization process and everything that springs up around it to try to turn this dirty ore into something that's going to be shiny and beautiful and sort of the lure of it, but also the terrible cost. So in East Tennessee, the people they hired to have the worst jobs in the plant, the hottest, most dangerous jobs, were Black and Mexican families that they sort of At one point, literally, we're just like sending buses down to other cities to bring workers in. And so you would get this sort of segregation. They sort of made up a city in Alcoa. They had a company town where the Black folk lived, and they had the most dangerous jobs. And then there was this entire white community that was trying to run separately. And one of the things that happens in the book too is, you know, the Stella and her Black partner have to sell to different constituencies when they're selling their moonshine. I don't know. I was just struck by it. It just seemed to resonate. It had such a huge effect on the area that I felt like I had to include it. And my dad, like my family all worked for Alcoa. And then when my dad moved to Chicago, he worked for Reynolds Aluminum, which was forcibly split off from Alcoa during the war because the government didn't want a monopoly for all aluminum manufacture. They basically made Reynolds Aluminum out of whole cloth and set up plants in Chicago and elsewhere. And weirdly enough, about 15 years ago, I think, Alcoa bought out Reynolds Aluminum and they're back to being one company again.
And such is the cycle of history. One of the things that struck me too was that, you know, you had to, it seems like you laid some hands on some old technology. How to start a Model A car. Oh my God. Who knew? Not me.
I knew that, you know, cars are such a big part of the Southern experience. Like, you grow up, you just want to be driving. And if you're a bootlegger, you got to have the car, right? So then I was trying to look at models of cars for what would be around at that time. And then I accidentally stumbled into how difficult it was just to start one. How many different levers? And so I sat in one that I wasn't allowed to start. And then I went back to the internet to watch these videos of like the multi-step procedures just to get these cars rolling. And so this is the kind of thing as a novelist where you're like, look, maybe I shouldn't spend time on this, but I found it so fascinating. Like, I'm putting this in. I'm going to have Stella being taught to drive by Abby. Why? Because I just felt like it needed it. I don't have a good rational reason for why that scene has to be there. I just found it fascinating.
So did I. And I think it gives an insight into the, you know, always the same, but ever-changing nature of technology. It's just the same as, you know, my son trying to explain to me how to work a 3D printer. And me back in the day trying to show him how to boot up a Unix computer. It's technology is always there and it's always foreign, and there's some generation that's just going, I don't know what this is and I probably don't want it.
Well, right. And like William Gibson says, you know, the future's arrived, but it's unequally distributed. And that was true. That's true in every period where you get these tremendous differences in levels of technology between, my grandparents were still had cows and were milking the cows by hand. And, you know, at the same time, they also could go get store-bought milk. And, you know, and electricity came. My mom remembers the day she came home from school and the house had been electrified. And so but lots of other stuff didn't change for decades. Like when I was a kid, my other grandmother's house still had an outhouse. Like there was no indoor plumbing in my grandmother's house when I was a kid. And so it's just such a weird thing how technology comes in. Like they got refrigerators with ice cold Coke before they got plumbing across the street at my grandmother's house. It was just so odd.
You know, too, we've talked a little bit about him, but a character that the reader just loves and really helps carry us through the story is Abby, Absalom. Talk about creating this character and setting up this, you know, idea of him being a father to Stella early on, you know, even though they're not related.
Yeah, so I the character of Abby, Absalom, you know, came out of basically, my uncles and my uncle's friends, there's a certain type of Southern character who seems to be maybe living on the edge, but is absolutely competent at a bunch of different things. And so my Uncle Clinton, who was the moonshiner, is also, stuffs animals and arranges skeletons and does all this sort of self-taught, the word just went out of my head, taxidermy, thank you. In fact, there's the raccoon head he gave me when I was 10 years old is on the wall over here. So I was always struck by these people could, my grandfather built his own house, like they could pour cement, they could do all these things. And so there was a certain character who's sort of unflappable. Maybe there's damage in his past, but he's not talking about it. And he's just solid. And I wanted, even in a horror novel, I wanted somebody solid that Stella would have in her corner, who's, he's not a direct relation, but he's always been there. He's like an uncle that's always been there on the mountain for her.
You know, early on in the novel, they mention what the god promises. And, you know, like it's the best thing ever. And the language you choose makes you think, oh no, this is a second coming that we're really not going to enjoy. And so I like you to talk about taking religious language and then slowly morphing it into, a very horrific potential.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up with that language. And, you know, church, I tell people, church made me a writer because I got so bored. So, you know, the language is washing over you. And we went to church 3 times a week, a lot of hours. But my parents always let me have a notebook. And so I'd be listening to the preacher, I'm also making up my own stories that were all science fiction and fantasy stories. That was always my thing right from the beginning. And, so for me, the language just sort of sounded like that. There's the Book of Revelations is a science fiction novel. It's an epic. It's one of those movies where everything blows up and everything comes to a head, and the special effects are amazing. And so that just, I never saw those as really separate things. Like that language is woven into. The horror and SF and fantasy stuff, they're all in my brain together. So that was not a difficult jump at all. But it all sort of lines up. There's a longing for apocalypse that's written into the DNA of a lot of evangelical religions, because that will be the day when the Lord returns and the dead will rise and will finally be proven right. Like everything that we believe will be paid off at once.
I'm not digging that idea of the dead rising and it doesn't sound bode well to me.
I know, but yeah, but it's, you know, it's there. And then as a kid, I just found this stuff fascinating. So of course they would use that language to just, there's something that's happening in this cave that's come to this mountain at some point in the past. And it may be that the Cherokee in the area had a different name for it. And it may be the other people in the area had a different name for it, but they've come up with, they've called it the God in the Mountain. Some of the women call it the ghost daddy. And they're trying to describe the indescribable, which is a fundamentally religious experience. And so the path in the book for me is the path of the way religious awakening happens in a person, which is at first there's awe and wonder. You're stepping before the burning bush and you have to take off your shoes and the glory of God is before you, like Moses meeting the burning bush. And then there's the teaching section where you're learning and you're trying to take in everything but the God is saying. And then there's this period later in your life when you're trying to say, wait a minute, I don't think I trust everything that I was told. I need to make up my own decisions about what I believe. And you take different pieces that you want to keep from your religion, and maybe you assemble your own belief system out of it. And I wanted Stella to go through that same system. She doesn't turn her back on everything, but she turns her back on Allah. And so that resonated with my own personal experience.
I love Stella's character and her character arc. It's super wonderful, and she's a great character to follow and read about. Talk about creating this character and creating the arc, and also Sunny as well, who is equally strong, equally powerful, and more mysterious than Stella, who's already plenty mysterious on her, all on her own.
Yeah, it's a tricky bit that Stella is also keeping secrets from the reader that get gradually revealed throughout the book. And no, Stella, you know, characters, the main characters for me usually just come. Like, it's like the way you get grits for breakfast in the South. Grits just come whether you ordered them or not. And so Stella, when I started thinking of this idea, Stella just sort of came to me, this kind of woman, Southern woman that I knew a lot of these women, and who are just tough, and they've got an inner strength that I admire. And so the trick was meeting her at 10 years old and then, you know, meeting her at 30 and keeping that essence of her the same, but she's become tougher and tougher. And I just love her to death because she speaks her mind. She's a moonshiner. She drinks a little too much. But she gets stuff done, and it's hard to intimidate a woman who's grew up in a farm. You know, when these city men try to stop her, and she's like, "How many animals have you killed? I've grown up in a farm. This is, I'm not scared here."
Now, something you'll often hear in charging from religious people is, "My God is a living God." When Stella says this, it's an entirely different thing. And I think this one of the things I like about this book is that it really forces you to think about the nature of God. On one hand, you know, you can imagine us as a speck on the outskirts of the galaxy, you know, and think, well, we're not much. But on the other hand, you think, well, you know, so here's this God. It's right here. It's with us. And we can't understand. I think that what I like about this is that you get at the unknowability of the God. The only way we know the God is the way we imagine him to be, it to be.
That's the key point, is that they keep trying to explain it, and it's fundamentally unexplainable. And this is maybe shared with, you know, when you spotted the Lovecraft references, where if there's something from outside, it may be beyond our frame of reference. We can try to tell stories about it, but that does not mean you actually have understood maybe anything about it. Yeah, and I like that experience of we are all here on the planet. We're not sure what the meaning of life is, and we're trying to understand things, and all of us have to come up with a story that makes sense to us. And Stella just made it come to a different story than the rest of her family has come to.
You know, and story is really important here, because the way you layer like history and the personal stories and then more history and more personal stories, talk about a story is half is more than half the word of history, right? So
yes, I mean, especially Southern stories, you know, famously, you know, with Faulkner, that, you know, the past isn't over, it isn't even the path, you know, this ongoing theme that you're shaped by your environment. And even though, like, I grew up in Chicago, these stories about our people and the way we used to do things and the way life was are sort of become part of your personal makeup. And so I don't know what to say about it, except that I love it in stories when the characters don't know exactly what's going on and they're forced to look for an explanation that may not be final. there's a thing that can happen sometimes in science fiction and fantasy stories where weird stuff is going on, and they meet the old man who explains, here are the rules. Here's what's exactly going on, and here's what the rules are for right now. And I always thought, no one ever showed up to tell me the rules. Or when they did, a second person would show up and tell me a different set of rules. And as a kid, you're like, well, how do I choose now? And then a third set, and then you're trying to make up your own rules. So I like the indeterminacy, and I realize that that can be frustrating for sometimes for certain readers. But as the kind of reader I am, I always kind of enjoyed it when you stop short of just explaining everything. I like, as Iris DeMent sings, a great singer said, let the mystery be. Sometimes you stop short and you don't know exactly what's going to happen next or what it all means.
Now, you've got characters who are kind of in one place, and they're confronting a couple of different problems. The problems created by Hendrix and his congregation, the problem created by the critter under the mountain. I like to talk about taking all these kind of like old time stuff where things can't happen fast, and then turning it into a really terrorizing, cannot look away from the page story to really, ramp up the tension in times. I mean, in current times, you wait 2 seconds and, somebody's chucking a nuclear bomb. Right. So it's not hard to, it's pretty easy to ramp up the tension these days. Talk about the way you ramp up the tension in your historical setting.
Yeah, so I thought about that a lot. One of the things I always fixate on early on when I'm planning a book is like, what is the structure that's going to help tell this story? And at a certain point, I realized that the structure of Revelator was going to be alternating timelines. It's going to be Stella when she's a young girl, when she first comes to the farm and is growing up from ages like 10 to 15, and have alternating chapters of adult Stella coming back when there's been a new Revelator chosen and she has to take action. She has to do something and settle all the scores in her past. And so, and we know something big happened to Stella that drove her out of the cove and made her this adult person who's more bitter later in life. So there's the tension you can get from writing from stories where you're trying to answer the question, how did this person get to there? And so that's one source of tension. But the other thing I was doing with the alternating storylines was try to end on a mystery on the young Stella story that is partially answered by the adult Stella story, which raises another question which should be answered by the young Stella, and keep you ping-ponging back and forth, hopefully entertained as a reader long enough to keep going and keep having raise a question every chapter. That was sort of the goal.
And two, this makes the character development and character arc the place where tension happens, and that's a really brilliant plan.
Yeah, and I love, for me, it's finding the character and going deep with them is most of the joy of the book. A lot of ways, I find that so enjoyable. And then always the trick is, well, how do I find a plot to be able to do everything I want to talk about with this character and what they're feeling? So then I'm always going back when I'm planning the book or writing the chapters, like, okay, so this is where Stella is right now in her life, but I need a scene that's dramatic. And so I always use Mike Nichols' advice, which is every scene has to be either a fight, a negotiation, or a seduction. And I'm always asking myself, is Stella negotiating with someone for power? Is she fighting with someone? Or and seduction can mean just trying to win somebody over to your side. And so every chapter, I'm trying to have some sort of dramatic thing that's at stake that she's working on. And how she solves the problem is her character.
And for me, One of the most important things about a novel is about a novel with a monster in it is I think as much as I and everybody else on the planet enjoyed the movie Jaws, it really kind of created this idea of the monster that it's just an appetite. It's going to eat you. And it doesn't even, I mean, you might be a garbage can. You might be, you know, a human being with a wonderful life, and it doesn't care and it doesn't even think about it. It just opens its mouth and goes. What I really like about this novel is one of the big mysteries is who is Ghost Daddy? And that's the really, you know, that's the a compelling character arc too. So talk about creating a character arc for something that is not human or even knowable by humans.
Right. I mean, I have in my head what the Ghost Daddy is trying to do and what it's been trying to do for all the decades of its very long life that it's trying to accomplish. And it eventually comes out in the novel what it's been trying to do. And in some ways, I see it as a science fiction novel in which sort of like the Ghost Daddy sort of a stranded astronaut who's trying to survive and is trying to manipulate the strange creatures it's found himself among to survive. And so that was the arc for me. It was like, Well, there were two things. One, from the outsider's point of view, the Ghost Daddy is barely glimpsed. We see slivers of it. We see parts of it in moonlight. And I was doing the kind of Jaws kind of thing where you keep the shark in the water as long as possible. You see the fins. You see the flash of teeth. You go away again. And then, like, you keep building that. So that's some of the tension that we were talking about earlier. But then I had to know what the Ghost Daddy wants, what it's trying to accomplish, and gradually have that revealed. So there is an answer for what Ghost Daddy was trying to attempt by the end of the book, but it doesn't have to be definitive. I don't need it to be definitive, but I have my answer.
Now, one of the things too that I really like is the way the book, you know, moves, takes place in the rural area in Cape Cod mostly, but alludes to the world outside kind of crowding in and creeping in different ways. And I'm thinking about Hendrick's Georgian Congregation, which is really enjoyable. Talk about creating those characters and using them to suggest about what you alluded to earlier, the William Gibson quote, which is one of my favorite, about the unequally distributed future reaching tendrils into the most untouched parts of this nation.
Yeah, I had this idea that it'd be good for Hendrick to come back in starting this new branch of a church, which is tied up with money. Like, some of the people he's attracted, he's dependent upon them to keep this church running until they can pay off all these promises. And that's not an untypical thing to happen in a lot of churches, which is like suddenly the people who've given the most money are having a bigger say than somebody without a lot of money. So Hendrick has promises to keep. And they're not sure they quite believe him, but they're in line. He brings them down there to prove to them that everything he's told them is true. And I like this idea of basically a modern church instantiating on the bones of an old, more primitive church. I like the idea of we're going to take this great little restaurant that you've got here with this food that you make that's beautiful, and we're going to make a franchise. And the modernization of religion that can happen really quickly. And you see it happens, you know, the growth of the modern Protestant churches explodes through the 40s and 50s and then, you know, leads to the mega churches that we get in the 80s and 90s and, you know, early 20s that are now maybe getting too big and they're collapsing in again. There's this, like you said, there's this cycle that keeps happening. But I was really interested in the idea of them trying to make a modern church with modern rules, with people with nice cars and good clothes, but they would have this built on the bones of this old time religion.
Now, your previous novel, or Spoonbenders, is it was optioned. How's that going?
It's funny to, you know, with the problem with Hollywood is that it takes forever to have anything happen, and most of the time nothing will. So we're in development at Netflix with Spoonbenders. I've got other things that are under option. The new book that's coming out next year is under option, and we're trying to put that together. But probably the odds are is that none of this, they'll not be able to gather enough money together, enough people to have all the magic happen where it finally gets to a screen. And so if it happens, fantastic. But part of me thinks, Daryl, keep your head down. Keep working on the next book, because you can't relax and count on any of this stuff. Because I think it was Chuck Wendig who said, you know, in publishing, people just tell you no, no, no. And then when they say yes, they're going to publish your novel. In Hollywood, people say yes, 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 until suddenly it's no and everything vanishes. So.
And of course, now, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I'm looking forward to the musical adaptation of this. This, you could do this thing on the stage. It'd be both spectacular and possible. And all you have to do is get a libretto going.
Well, music's a big part of this, and it's a big part of Southern culture, and especially part of church culture. I grew up singing these four-part harmonies, and there's shape note music, which is a style of gospel singing that I just love. Before we started recording, I was saying I was back in Cape Cod visiting, and they started holding church services every Sunday in some of the churches. And I went into the Primitive Baptist Church, and it's a wooden timbered place, and they're doing these intense harmonies that are just shaking the timbers. It's just an amazing sound. So if it goes to the stage, if we make a musical, that would have to be part of it, the shape note singing, but also all the Appalachian music I grew up with. I grew up with a lot of bluegrass. I adore that music. And so that would be the theme. That would be the soundtrack of that show.
That sounds wonderful. I've been speaking with Daryl Gregory about his latest novel, Revelator. Thank you for joining me, Daryl.
Thank you, Rick. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.